Spike Lee at Harvard. 5 joints. At the Grolier, I was the shipping clerk, employed in a corner, slim enough for a book. I was surrounded by books, by boxes of books and photographs of poets, and by customers who loved poetry, and by famous poets who were also customers. And that is where I got my first glimpse of the life of poetry, through the Grolier's cinematic glass window, and where the life of poetry first governed me toward discipline and surrender, to work through a mandate of silence so as not to take advantage of my position, as if any black person would want to use shipping and sweeping to create an audience for apprenticeship. The Grolier's interior was all literary integrity and repetition, as if lit by the alliterative gaze of illiterate lettered spirits, its own elite enemy of non-intellectuals and integration. Should we separate the black poets from the white poets to make it easier for customers to find African American work? My employer asked. Well, at least she asked. One part of me thought, what's wrong with this white woman? And the other part of me thought, hell no. But all I said was, I don't think slow. Said it slowly, so as to suggest the lyric range of attitude. Another better way to frame this is to say that then there was only one black poet on the wall of photographs. I, interrupting the white typeface of American detachment, a single profile of personas, like a caesura in buttermilk. A sonnet surrounded by the shadows of ideas and knives of artificial light. The Grolier was day for night for nothing but their work and their likeness, the colorless absence of noise between images and words. Shelving was like casting, being up on the ladder like directing, all perspectives of craft, mind to theft. Yes, letterpress chapbooks, signed overstock, folded broadsides. No, of all the books I'd stolen, I'd never stolen from the Grolier, but you would not have known that from the auctioneer's way she moved through my work, like an apparition of inventory chained to suspicion. 3 times around the center display table under which Pumpkin, the shop's dog, slept was like 1 time around Ben Hur's Coliseum in Monsieur Hulot's hiccuping jalopy, as publishing, like the Gulf War, filled the world with more ghosts. In my other life, I was given an audience, the keys to darkness, an office of shadows, and an editor's sense of control over my own crew of light. Forgive me, champions of identity politics, for not just saying I had an evening job as a projectionist security guard at the Harvard Film Archive in the last line of Le Corbusier's ramped prose poem of glass and stone, whose screen, like big paper, was wide as the sky and less restricted than the Grolier's marquee-like anthology, where the white people in the frame photographs rejected the glamour of the white people in movie stills. My favorite being the photograph of Gordon Kearney the shop's original owner, and Luisa Solano, his young assistant, locked in their own couplet for final cut. As author, I pray this last stanza won't fade or break into whiteness. The tense silence at the end of writing, down there in the sink between thinking and feeling. This is where the soundtrack would begin if poetry paid enough for one, if the public paid more for poetry. Dear listener, are you as swole by this as I was living it? These five different takes of the same sickness. Already you must be tired of these uneven 4, 5, 6 word lines. If so, toss a trash can like a lidless metaphor through this poem's narrative wild style into the sepia flashback of any number of book parties. For every insult and broken promise, the crash, a critical review, the flying glass, poets running for cover with nothing to cover themselves but their own book covers. Call the cops if you like. Their slanted shadows can't spell a hold on craft.